Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite Saturday morning program, heard exclusively here on WEEB. I am Steve Woodward. My sidekick, David Hensley, is out saving the world from itself. So I am happy and delighted to be joined today by Kent Meisgades, who has been through here a few times. Good morning, Kent.
Good morning. It's an honor to be back.
Thank you for coming in. We are, as always, brought to you by our beloved sponsor, The Marketplace Restaurant and Catering, since 1980, where you need to go for breakfast and lunch and all your catering needs. I try to have lunch there about once a week. It's always a pleasure. Coming up later in the program, we will have a conversation with former State Treasurer Dale Falwell, who is ensconced in retirement as of the first of this year, but he's paying attention to the dumpster fire that is both Medicaid expansion and the state health insurance underfunded plan. So we'll talk to him about those things a little later in the program. And before we begin with our conversation today with Kent and getting caught up on Taking Aim and the many targets that are before us, I do want to mention very solemnly that earlier this week, one of our brothers in the fight here in Moore County, Bill Damastis, passed away. Bill was a rugged individual. I was just with him a couple of days before his passing, and this is a guy who had never given in to his advanced years, neither physically nor mentally. And we will miss him, and we will keep his wife and constant companion, Alice, in our prayers going forward. It would be insufficient to say that Bill was a Republican volunteer. He was so much more than that. He was a soldier in the fight. He was a leader. Bill Damastis, rest in peace, my brother. As we always do, we begin the program by identifying from a long roster of candidates public enemy number one. There's always many, many folks who vie for this title, this dubious distinction each and every week. And frequently they are names that are very well known to you. Some of our elected officials, I think last week, it might have been Roy Cooper or Tom Tillis, or I don't know. There's a rotation there, as you might imagine. But this week we choose from a more obscure individual who nonetheless earned this public enemy distinction big time. So here's the story. Tragically, as we know, on September 10th, the great patriot and really cultural leader, especially among the nation's youth, Charlie Kirk, was brutally murdered while delivering remarks on a campus in Utah. And as we also know, tragically, within hours and into the next day, many deranged individuals, disgusting and vile people on the left, took to social media to express, in many cases, their delight with his demise, the fact that he had not just died, but that he had been assassinated. And many of them could not wait to express these vile sentiments. And of course, many of them, surprised as they were, met with backlash from their friends, from their colleagues, and from, in many cases, their employers. At Wake Forest University, an athletic trainer named Bridget Sullivan did that very thing. After Charlie's death, she posted the lyrics from a song entitled "He Had It Coming, He Had It Coming" on September 11th, the day after, alongside a comment that in which she said, quote, "This audio is all I have to say about that. He had it coming." Word spread very quickly, and among those who noticed her, I won't even call it inappropriate, I'll just call it evil reaction, was our representative, Pat Harrigan, who I believe represents the 10th Congressional District. He is, I want to say, a first-term representative, ex-military, very impressive guy with a very bright future in the political arena. He wasn't having any of it, and he took to his own Twitter account to call for her firing and reposted the screenshots of her Instagram post along with her biography with Wake Forest University. He wrote, "If a staff member is openly celebrating the assassination of Charlie Kirk, it crosses every line of decency and professionalism." So, what happened? He was able to report shortly thereafter that Wake Forest had fired Bridget Sullivan. Bridget Sullivan took exception to that. She, believe it or not, this is the audacity of these people. She is now suing Representative Harrigan, seeking damage claims of more than $75,000 because he posted the announcement that she had been fired for her reprehensible reaction to Charlie Kirk's death. Now, what is her premise? And by the way, that post by Harrigan was liked by 23,000 Twitter users. So that's pretty, that reaction tells you everything you need to know. But she's suing because she argues that, no, I was not fired, and therefore Harrigan got it wrong. But what actually happened was that she and Wake Forest, quote, mutually agreed that it would be best to part ways. I don't see the distinction there. And I just think she was shocked and amazed that she was being held to account and made to pay a price for her for the nature of her comments. And I salute Wake Forest. And I have a feeling that this lawsuit will not get very far, and that Representative Harrigan will not be spending a lot in legal fees to resolve this matter. But she is public enemy number one. Now, of course, we're finding as well that there's always somebody right nipping at the heels of public enemy number one, and we've decided to give that person a title too, public embarrassment number one. This week, and probably almost every week, that nod is going to the governor of North Carolina, Josh Stein. It pains me to say the word governor and his name in the same breath, but the voters seem to think that that was what we needed last fall. So he is the governor. And you may recall, right at the beginning of the month of October, I will say, our lawmakers in Raleigh proposed and passed a sweeping crime bill that basically responded to the brutal murder on a Charlotte transit car of a young Ukrainian refugee named Irina, and it became known as Irina's Law. They passed that through the House and then the Senate rather robustly, not unanimously, but close to unanimously. And there it then proceeded to the governor's desk. Now, this is a law that not only addresses people like the murderer of Arena, who had been out 14 times, arrested and released 14 times, who had proven cases of mental illness, mentally deranged, unstable behavior as part of these arrests, and yet was again on the streets, able to board this train and kill her with a small knife. But in addition to that, this law addresses the cashless bail trend, the ridiculous and absurd notion that someone is on bail having not posted any bond, which is sort of like when they let the illegal immigrants across the border and didn't require anything but an IOU saying, I'll come back for my immigration court appearance. Yeah, good luck with that. It also, the law scales back the discretion of magistrates and judges to release a person on cashless bail. It makes the bar much higher in order to be set free without bail and without being held until such time as a trial occurs. This was an important bill, long overdue, and yet Governor Stein waited until the last possible day, the 10th day after it was passed, to sign it into law. Now, why did he do that other than to be obstinate and other than to seek the approval of his far-left base? That goes without saying. But he also said that he had some other reasons for it, and I have struggled to understand his twisted logic here. He says that he took to a video to explain why he waited. He said that he signed the bill because it alerts the judiciary to take a special look at people who may pose unusual risks of violence before determining their bail. Fair enough. But then he complains that the law fails to focus appropriately on the threat that people pose instead of their ability to post bail, and he made the false claim that the bill also would make legal the execution of criminals by firing squad, those whose crimes rise to the level of receiving the death penalty. Of course, we haven't been applying the death penalty here for about 20 years, and that firing squad thing came up on the Democrat side as an extreme example of what the Republicans might try to do in the future if other forms of capital punishment cannot be agreed upon. But certainly the bill was never intended to impose firing squad levels of execution. Let's hear more from Stein. Play clip one.
The law fails, however, to focus appropriately on the threat that people pose instead of their ability to post bail. And most alarming, the General Assembly sprung a last-minute amendment that aims to bring about execution by firing squad to North Carolina. It's barbaric. There will be no firing squads in North Carolina during my time as governor. Beyond those specific concerns with the legislation, I'm troubled by its lack of ambition or vision. It simply does not do enough to keep you safe. That's why I'm calling on the legislature to come back and pass my comprehensive public safety package, a package that includes more cops on the beat, well-trained and public-spirited, building trust in the community and keeping people safe. Violence prevention measures like keeping kids out of gangs and getting people off drugs. And if we're serious about making people safer, we have to acknowledge the role that guns and mental health play and violence that we're seeing all across the country. We can respect people's Second Amendment rights while also ensuring that anyone who is violent or dangerously mentally ill does not have access to guns.
Well, Kent, I want you to weigh in on that. The big flaw in what he's saying there is that you've got Democrat sheriffs and mayors in some of our cities who have deliberately defunded police, who have de-emphasized law enforcement. So I don't know what he's talking about, because his own people are not at all in favor of more robust policing and certainly not raising the red flag on mentally ill people on the streets, we tend to ignore them.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, he's typical to deflect the tension and to twist and turn things. And it always comes back to the same thing, right? Go light on criminals, especially certain groups of criminals in certain towns. Take the guns away from the law-abiding people. We can't have that. And then this absurd notion there about, again, about gun control. Well, this, in this particular instance, this young lady was killed by a fellow with a pocket knife. So are we going to start now confiscating pocket knives? Some countries have even advocated for that. So it's just typical word salad from a Democrat, establishment Democrat, who's really pandering to the far left.
And who knows that this bill is legitimate, and who knows he had to sign it, and ultimately he did. And then he'll take credit going forward,
right,
for examples of how the bill is making our streets and our public transit safer. We mentioned earlier in the program Charlie Kirk, and we can't talk about him enough. It's been now a 1 month since he was assassinated. And boy, it's hard to believe that that much time has already passed. It is important to point out that his campus tour schedule is continuing, and that they have not canceled one stop since his assassination. And many of his biggest fans and followers in the media and political worlds are taking turns participating in these campus rallies. Earlier this week, at Montana State, the keynote speaker was Ohio gubernatorial candidate and former presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy, who I would say, if there's anyone capable of advancing the mantle of Charlie Kirk and appealing to the same demographic, certainly he could be that man. But he shared some very poignant comments about the last time he was with Charlie Kirk before Charlie was murdered. Play clip two.
That is the question of our generation. It is the most important question for your generation. Really, to put America first, we first have to answer what America is. And it turns out this was actually the subject of my very last in-person conversation with Charlie when he visited Ohio on August 25th. The last time I ever saw him in person, we had a very private conversation, just the two of us, one-on-one. What's an American, I asked him. And in classic Charlie form, he told me, I don't have the answer, but I'll tell you what it's not. It's not a race, I know that, but it's not just paperwork either, that much I know. I agree with what Charlie said. Our shared American identity isn't about a race, and it isn't about government paperwork. We're a nation defined by a set of ideals that united an extraordinary group of people 250 years ago. If you're the descendant of a particular race or lineage, but you don't actually subscribe to those ideals, then you're not really an American, not in the truest and deepest sense of that word. And if you happen to have physically entered our country and been granted a piece of paper by the government, but you don't actually believe in the ideals of our country, then once again, you're not really an American, not in the deepest sense of that word. But if you do believe in those ideals, wait your turn. Enter the country legally, work hard, play by the rules, make your contributions, take your oath of allegiance to the country, assimilate into the country, and become a citizen. Then you're every bit as much of an American as anybody else in this country.
Very well said by Vivek, who is, I think, likely to become the next governor of the state of Ohio, and at the age of, I don't know, 42 or 43, has a very bright political future ahead of him, no doubt about it. Hey, a reminder that coming up later in the program, we will have a conversation with former North Carolina State Treasurer Dale Falwell on some topics that you will find of great interest. You know, when I saw the reporting in the Pilot newspaper a few days ago about the release of the long-awaited, with bated breath, grade-level proficiency scores assigned to Moore County schools, and the wrist wringing and heavy breathing about how exciting it was that they have improved and that now Moore County is the seventh highest performing public school district out of 115 in the state. When I saw those things, I thought of you, and I had just read a day or two before that a story about how the Commonwealth of Virginia has done something that most states wouldn't think of. They've actually voted to require higher math and reading standards for their students. In other words, when they test them, the standards, the bar will be higher to achieve a reasonably good score. Tell us, so bring us down to earth here on how we should look at these proficiency scores and how we should contrast that with the rating of our schools, which are, you know, we have 9 B rated, not 9 C rated, 9 B rated, and actually 3 that are D, as in dog rated, and only 1 A rated. How should we look at all this sort of landscape of public education?
Yeah, it's a good point, Steve. One has to take a historical look at how academic performance has been measured in this country, in this state. Not so long ago, and you probably remember, I don't know what your schools used to measure your performance. Ours was the California test and the Iowa test, and I was in schools in rural schools in Kentucky and northern Alabama, not exactly known for academic achievement, but our exams were what are called nationally normed. So if you got a certain score on that nationally normed test, you could compare your performance to the rest of the country. And even back then, we were a pretty competitive country among states and eventually, you know, globally. So parents were interested. I'm not really that interested to know how good is my child doing compared to the school a couple of miles away or the next county. How's he doing compared to the rest of the nation? And, of course, we're in a global economy. So we ought to really be concerned about how is my child or how are these kids that we're paying for with our taxes, how are they going to compare against the leading states and leading countries in education, places like Hong Kong, Singapore, Finland, Switzerland, et cetera, because that's who they're going to compete against, whether they intend to or not. That's just the reality. You could do that in the past in North Carolina until Jim Hunt became governor, and he's ironically was called the education governor. Prior to that, we had nationally normed tests used here in this state. Iowa tests, California tests, they varied. Well, North Carolina generally was at the bottom of the barrel in comparing it to other states. And it was kind of always a joke, right? I live in Alabama. It was always, thank goodness we've got Mississippi, because it was almost guaranteed they were going to be below us. And yet you've got an article here showing they seem to have turned themselves around. Well, Jim had a problem, right? How does he improve the schools without really making the schools and the teachers accountable for it? Well, let's do the easy thing. Let's just change the tests. So they came up with a set of tests back then early on. This was late 90s. It was called the ABCs of Education. And since then, of course, they've changed the name. But if anyone's interested in the history, go just search on ABCs of Education. Most of those articles back then were written by Terry Stoops, who's the education expert at Carolina Journal, John Locke Foundation. He documented it very well, what actually happened, and how the performance, the actual performance of student of the schools went down as the standards were lowered. So there we are. We're using a set of tests that are unique to North Carolina. They were dumbed down, just by the way, the same way that the ACT and the SAT score tests have been dumbed down over the years. And so suddenly the kids are looking great, right? Well, after a while, they didn't look so great anymore compared to whatever goals they had set. So, you know, they're changing the goalposts once again. So let's stop looking at the actual performance. Can Johnny read? Does Johnny know what a zip code is? You know, basic stuff. Let's just measure the trend from 1 year to the next. And that, of course, assumes that everything else is static, right? That no one else is improving. Well, they are improving at the same time. So that's where we are. Most of the time now, you won't see the actual performance in terms of raw scores. you'll only see how does it compare to what that particular school or that class did last year. Well, as a parent, I don't care. That doesn't mean anything to me. I want to know how is my child going to do when he's competing against someone from another state or another country. That's what matters to me.
Right. So when I see this reporting on the GLP score for the current cycle, and again, that's a grade level proficiency, GLP, and I'm told that in Moore County, the composite score for all of the tested areas, reading, math, and science, is 63%. That's two-thirds are proficient.
Yeah, that's right.
Apparently. Yeah. And that's supposed to be laudable because it's 8.7% higher than the state average. Well, in North Carolina, according to the National Report Card for 2024 that was released at the beginning of this year, reading scores were 3 points lower than compared to as recently as 2019. Math scores were 3 points lower than as recently as 2019, in other words, pre-pandemic. And science scores at the eighth grade level were 4 points lower compared to 2019. So I don't really see the state average as being the gold standard for anything.
No. It's kind of like trying to walk up on a very fast downward escalator. You know, you're going downhill, but maybe not quite as fast if you turn around. But the rest of the states or the better states are advancing on it. So, you know, the bigger question is, of course, in my mind, again, how are these kids going to do in a global economy? Well, in the rest of the world, they use something called the PISA exam. This came out of Europe. When we lived in Germany, we were always interested. Well, how are our schools doing against France, Switzerland, other places like that, and the PISA? You can look these things up too. There is a way to measure U.S. school performance. Some of the schools here use PISA, typically only private schools. Generally, we score somewhere 25th, 30th, 35th against others in basic reading, math, and writing. And it just continues to decline. Now, there is a contrast to these dumbed-down, unique tests here. There are many schools that use nationally normed exams. Most of your private schools do. Many of your charter schools do. Certainly the home schools do. Again, the Iowas are still there, also known as the ITBS. Another one has become very popular, the CLT, the Classical Learning Test. Most of your really top-end schools, they use the CLT. It's coordinated through the University of Dallas, so it's a really fine private college in Dallas. And some local schools here actually do very well on the CLT nationally. One is the schools we've been privileged to work with, Thales Academy. Another one is Classical Conversations, our homegrown company here for homeschools. They rank within the top 25th nationally.
Robert Borton's.
Exactly. And that's a tough exam. That's a very tough exam. And yet there are many schools that are doing excellent work there. I mean, they're so far ahead of the public schools, you can't even hardly compare them. And this really hit home when I listened to the new director of this innovative high school speak to a group of us manufacturers last week. And she said, well, our primary focus is on children that are in danger of dropping out of high school. And she said, well, we have some fundamental weaknesses here. She said, my students don't have a signature, and they don't know what a zip code is. And I'm thinking, okay, and we're manufacturers, we're supposed to hire these children in a couple of years. They're so far behind, it's pretty much hopeless.
And to clarify what you're talking about, the Moore Innovative High School is a collaboration, the first of its kind in this county, between Moore County Schools and Sand Hills Community College. They have launched the school this year for the first time with a small charter class of just under 70 students. I believe these are ninth graders.
Currently, there are 65 ninth graders, and they'll add a grade per year. Yeah.
So it's not functioning the way that it will when it gets fully subscribed, which will be a balance between curriculum focused and then
skills training,
vocational and skills mm-hmm. training. Mm-hmm. But to your point, if we want to deliver on the promise of job-ready students, we have to sort of make sure our metrics are aligned with what the employers are looking for.
Yeah, thank you for saying metric. In manufacturing today, it's all global, so everyone has to be equally skilled at both standard American units as well as metric. Are they teaching metric? I don't know. It's true. I mean, we have to do that. You know, I've got in front of me here a chart from her presentation. And remember, this is a highly qualified, tongue-in-cheek here, director for this new
principal.
Mm-hmm. She was an elementary school principal. Now, she's a very vivacious, you know, very optimistic leader. And I wish her well, but I mean, she says in order to qualify for the funds that they have for this school from the state, they have to focus on three things. Number one is at risk of dropping out. Number two, first generation college students or students who would benefit from an accelerated experience. I don't know what that means, the last one. But, you know, as a manufacturer, I look at that first one. I say, are you kidding me? Now, there are some great kids out there that need a little bit of guidance, and maybe they're more excited about making things than just, you know, sitting and listening to a boring lecture. And yet, you know, most of us in manufacturing, we're looking for the standout students that are good in math, they're good in science, they're good in physics, they know how to make things. We tend to use a lot of automation nowadays in our facilities. You have to have very good skills, and you have to have very good math, and you have to be able to communicate. So, you know, I look at that. To me, that's a showstopper. You know, if I'm supposed to hire someone that comes out of a school aimed at helping kids at risk of dropping out.
Yeah. Well, of course, it's a work in progress, and we will follow it closely as we go forward. But you mentioned earlier the school systems, and this is maybe a good way to wrap up on this topic. The school systems in the state of Mississippi, which were once considered almost a lost cause, right, have now staged this rebound. It's being referred to as the Mississippi miracle. What did they do in Mississippi, and why don't we duplicate that?
Well, first thing is, like most of the South, unfortunately, we're still not there yet. They shifted entirely over the last 50 years to a strongly conservative government. You know, we're still kind of, we're like the last ones here in North Carolina. That's one of the things they did. So they're not as beholden to the teacher unions as they used to be. Basically, they put the onus onto the parents. So instead of social promotion, they say, your child is going to be held back a year unless his grades improve. Well, shazam. It actually worked, right? Because, you know, it's the prospect of a child hanging around the house at age 20 and they still don't have a high school diploma. I don't know about you, but that's a scary thought as a parent. So, you know, obviously enough of them care about their kids that they somehow motivated them to do better.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that one for sure. Kent, it has been great having you with us today. The time has flown by. But we had a lot of ground to cover. A reminder that in a moment we will have a conversation with former State Treasurer Dale Falwell. We would also like to thank all of you for joining us. And let's keep an eye on what happens with the things we talked about today. We'll follow up on the lawsuit against Representative Pat Harrigan, and we'll see what Josh Stein has to say when some of these tougher crime laws start to kick in on our streets, and what happens in, especially in a city like Charlotte, where there is starting to be a trend in the wrong direction in terms of violent and persistent crime and even homicide, which heretofore had not really been much of an issue. We'll see if they can pay attention to that. And of course, last but not least, we'll keep an eye on the growth of Turning Point USA in the era after Charlie Kirk, and I think chapters are coming to Moore County. We'll keep an eye on that. As we've mentioned earlier in the show, our guest today is Dale Falwell, the former North Carolina State Treasurer, two terms, 2016 to 24, now enjoying retirement. Good morning, Mr. Falwell.
Good morning to you, Brad and Steve, and it's great to be back with my good friends in Moore County, and hope things are going well.
Many of you, many of our listeners, of course, will recall that on alternating Wednesdays when he was treasurer, Dale called into this radio station in the morning live. And what I will always remember and greatly admire was that the morning after you were defeated in the primary, you called in anyway. And I thought that was a testimony to your character. So we're glad to have you back with us. There's a couple of topics at play right now that you are intimately familiar with and that have not taken care of themselves in your absence, have not self-healed. One is, of course, the perilous situation faced with the expansion of Medicaid in the state, Medicaid coverage, I should say, which for decades North Carolina avoided wisely, I think. And that was your viewpoint. But then on the as he was headed out the door, Governor Cooper gave in to his base and expanded Medicaid to, I want to say, another 600,000 citizens of the state. And wouldn't you know it, here we are in the fall of 2025, and there's a shortfall in terms of funding it. The House and the Senate are at an impasse on doing that, north of $300 million shortfall right now. And meanwhile, the providers are being warned that they can face rate reductions between 3 and 8% at a minimum. That's one story that we'll talk about. And then as well, the condition of the state health insurance plan, which, as you have pointed out over the years, is imperiled by the medical cartels that thrive and really are ignored by both parties. So let's talk about Medicaid. The expansion is done. What do you think we should expect going forward with that, based on just what we're seeing here, but also what other states have experienced?
Well, in the accounting world, we have a term called estimable improbable. What you just outlined to your listeners and what is actually happening as far as Medicaid overruns was estimable and it was probable.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Governor Cooper a few moments ago, but it was Republicans who authorized this Medicaid expansion.
Excellent point, with the majority, yes.
And yes, and with for the whole time that I've been in Raleigh, nearly 20 years, Republicans had always been opposed to Medicaid expansion. And I'm not as close to it as I once was, but it was my understanding before I left office that they agreed to this Medicaid expansion with some caveats that if the federal government chose to cut back on their reimbursement, then maybe Medicaid would stop being expanded. I don't know the ins and outs of that legislation, but I just want to make your listeners feel even smarter than they already are. If they think something's wrong with health care, they're right.
Mm-hmm.
None of your listeners consume health care. It consumes them. It's the only product in their life where they don't know the price and the value of it, even after they have consumed it. And these cost overruns in Medicaid expansion or in the state health plan are the result of North Carolina, according to Forbes or Fortune, having the highest cost health care in the United States. That's because the health care cartel, and if you go to Webster's Dictionary for your listeners, the cartel is defined as associations which are formed to raise prices or limit competition. That's exactly what has happened with health care, and it's being endorsed by the Republicans in the North Carolina House and North Carolina Senate, who refuse to get behind transparency, refuse to get behind reference-based pricing, refuse to get behind repealing of the certificate of need. So, you know, this all world, in our whole world these days, Brad and Steve, we talk about Republicans and Democrats. This issue lies at the feet of the Republicans who are in charge in this state.
And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but if the providers of health care are seeing their funding reduced and hospitals are not provided enough to pay their employees what they should be paid, and doors start closing in these facilities, won't the voters notice that the next time they get a chance to cast a ballot? I mean, shouldn't the Republicans be a little bit more leery of this ticking time bomb?
Yeah, you know, voters aren't being leveled with. The fact is that in the accounting world, we're told to watch the cash. We have one nonprofit in this state that doesn't have hundreds of millions or millions or even billion, but multi-billion dollars in the bank. So these folks who talk about, you know, the limiting of health care somehow know that they keep putting more marble and more granite in their executive offices, buying more property, taking it off the tax rolls, and charging higher and higher prices. You know why they do that? Because they can.
Because they can. Mm-hmm. Because the pipelines are just churning with cash, and it's our money.
Because we have a opportunity. The Republicans in this state have had the opportunity for years and years to lead the nation in terms of transparency, tell people what health care costs, in terms of competition. That means not restricting the supply of something, and so more people can compete, which would result in lower prices. The Republicans in the General Assembly, in the words of the gentleman who just passed away tragically in an airplane accident in Franklin, North Carolina, who wrote the song, Jesus Take the Wheel, the Republicans in the General Assembly have the wheel to reform health care in this state and lower cost.
And interestingly, you have called upon the General Assembly prior to your leaving office to provide the funding that is needed to keep the health insurance plan solvent. But our current state treasurer, Brad Briner, is on the record as saying that he doesn't believe the General Assembly can or should fix this problem. I'm quoting a recent article. And then he says, we are going to have to do a number of uncomfortable things. The obvious one is premiums, which by that he means raising them. Is that really the solution?
No, the solution is to stop screaming past each other and have an honest, open conversation where everybody can be invited, where the General Assembly is shown mathematically where they have underfunded state health plan for decades. Decades. This is not a current problem. To tell you how severe this problem is, our unfunded liability, billions and billions of dollars on the state health plan, on a per capita basis, puts us right behind, a few years ago, right behind the state of Illinois. The same Illinois that you talk about all the time as being insolvent.
Right.
So we can be optimistic and thankful for our state debt going down by 60%, which it did under my administration, the General Assembly eliminating corporate income tax, cutting personal income. We can be optimistic and thankful for all those things. But the fact is, this is a ticking time bomb. And to finance the unfundedness, to finance the not funding of the pension plan, the state health plan, on the backs of those that teach, protect, and otherwise serve, is something that I never stood for. And the leadership in the General Assembly never cared for me because I took that position.
And as it stands, the hospital cartels don't have no motivation to get control of their costs, and instead they're just going to let them keep going up, and that's just going to accelerate the insolvency, I guess, right?
They keep consolidating health care in the hands of fewer and fewer people, choking off supply, having complete control, in my opinion, with the consultants and the lobbyists and those that don't have the courage to register as lobbyists and make sure that their game, nobody changes their game.
And just to be clear, when we read media reports that put the indebtedness of the state health plan at just north of $500 million and headed toward a shortfall projected by 2027 to be $1.4 billion. Your contention is that those numbers are very low, that in fact the health plan is billions with a B, plural, in debt and becoming increasingly moving toward insolvency. Is that right?
That's right, because we, for decades, our state promised workers after 5 years and 1 day of service to be entitled to lifetime health care, eligible for lifetime health care. But they never put any money aside for that. There should be no difference in opinion about the facts and the mathematics. It's just people trying to spin things in a way that leave people with a headache where they can't really understand what's happening. And what's happening is that the General Assembly has not done its job to increase access, quality, and lower cost of health care in this state.
And the thing that's really frustrating now about our General Assembly is they're taking a page out of the federal playbook, the Capitol Hill playbook, and they've gotten to the point where they just don't seem capable of passing a budget. You know, so they're doing these so-called mini budgets. One of them contains some additional funding to cover the cost of Medicaid expansion, but it wasn't enough. And as recently as a couple of days ago, both of our representatives here in Moore County, Representative Jackson and State Senator McInnes, were in a meeting at the community college here locally, and they were asked, "What is the status of the budget? When's it going to get done?" And they just didn't have an answer. There doesn't seem to be any confidence that is an achievable goal. And I don't know about you, but I, as a citizen, I find that unacceptable.
Well, this has been going on for decades, unfortunately, and I think we're in a very uncertain world. And all this does is bring more uncertainty to people's lives, which I'm opposed to.
Yeah, they don't, especially when it comes to very basic fundamental things like health care and education, things that as Americans we should take for granted are going to be available to us and the very best standards in the world as well. And let's keep in mind when we talk about funding the state health insurance plan, we're talking about an impact on 750,000 plus state employees. This is not some small niche group of people. These are real people in real lives that need prescription drugs that are affordable, that need medical care that is accessible, and you know, to take that away from three quarters of a million, or to diminish it for 750,000 people can be nightmarish, to say the least.
Well, look, one out of every 10 adult North Carolinians is attached to this. Secondly, let me put it in context. The family premium that they're talking about going up on the family premium, some families in Moore County who work for the school system, they have to work 1 week out of every four to pay this premium. Can you imagine Walmart, as much as they purchase, they'd be had to pay the highest prices? Why should the largest purchaser of this product in this state be paying the highest prices? And that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah, that's actually turned on its head, isn't it? Upside down. Makes no sense. Well, do you? We're talking to former state treasurer Dale Falwell, who is comfortably ensconced in retirement. Do you ever have impulses to get back in the political arena?
Well, I went to Winston-Salem State and UNC Greensboro. I was not a literary major. I was an accounting major. But I understand that if you look at the Latin meaning of the word politic, poly means to address the affairs of the city. And I think all of the Weeb listeners know what a tick is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always interested in helping anyone who is trying to save money, save minds or save lives, period, and fix things. But there's, I don't see any smoke signal coming out of Washington, D.C., or generally Raleigh, of anyone who's truly interested in fixing these problems that affect average North Carolinians.
And yet, they don't just go away by ignoring them. We know that. And right now in Raleigh, you know, you've got a governor now who, you know, there are times when I think that Governor Stein makes Cooper look like a man of principle, as strange as that sounds. But to your point, also the Republicans with the majority, the supermajority on the Republican side and a simple majority on the House side are complicit as well. And I guess we're just going to have to rattle some cages next time next year when we have chances to go to the polling places again.
Well, I presume that you know things like that could happen, but I mean, the fact is that we need to get rid of counterfeit conservatives, and I know the Weeb listeners are familiar with this term called rhinos. There's something worse than a rhino, and that is a person who pretends to be a conservative but does things not just in their voting but behind the scenes to offset that.
Yeah.
And I call them counterfeit conservatives.
Right. Emphasis on con, I guess.
Yeah.
You might
say. Right.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, when we talk about health care, CON is the certificate of need, and that's also what it stands for.
Good point. And the certificate of need, it's kind of in the weeds, but it is it's a problem that could be solved if there were people willing to responsibly be the adults in the room and deal with it.
Right. Well, it's not the end-all, be-all, but it is important.
Yeah. Well, and when, you know, the frustration is that that North Carolina is recognized as a vibrant state, a growing state, a state that is attracting industry and new business, and a state that is robust in many regards. But then it's a shame for those who live here and, you know, are in the trenches every day going to work and doing their jobs and taking care of their families, that they have to deal with the uncertainties that you mentioned with regard to Medicaid in the case of those who are eligible, hopefully only those eligible. And then, of course, there are those who are state employees and their health care coverage.
Well, but, exactly. And, you know, the fact is the conservative answer to these problems is increase the supply of health care, lower the cost, so more people could afford to pay their premiums.
Sounds pretty simple.
I mean, why can't we just go back to conservative principles?
Well, I will say this, Treasurer Falwell. I'm sure that there are many people in our audience who would be delighted to have you lead us in that quest if you ever want to come back and run for office again. And there are... There will be an appetite for that. But in the meantime, I would like to thank you for joining us today and giving us your time and your insights into these issues. And we hope to have you back again in the future.
Well, I appreciate it. And, you know, I will say that, you know, when former state party chair Michael Whatley and the current chair, you know, they have had no interest in my public service, and because, you know, at the end of the day, in my opinion, they don't want conservatives who really want to solve problems by asking the tough questions.
And that is an unfortunate commentary, and that is where we will leave it. Thank you again, Dale, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Bless all of your listeners at the Weeb.
You bet. Thank you. Well, again, we thank Dale Falwell for joining us today, and Kent Mizegades as well. David Hensley is threatening to be back next week from his global adventure. I'm sure he'll fill us in on all of that. We are Taking AIM, your favorite Saturday morning program, heard exclusively here, only on WEEB 97.3 FM, 990 AM, 104.1 FM. Ladies and gentlemen, as always, I am Steve Woodward, and we hope you'll join us again when we're right back here, Taking AIM.